You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Telemark Lodge in Cable was one of the state's top winter getaways for many years, but bankruptcy led to its closing in 2013. We'll look back at the history of the lodge and current plans for a renovation and reopening. First, injured workers are having a harder time getting compensation in recent years. That's according to a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Under a panel appointed by Governor Walker, there have been more appeals of workers' compensation decisions, and those appeals have been more favorable to employers. Dee Hall is the managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Luke Kingry is a workers' compensation attorney who practices in Eau Claire and Madison. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Dee, let's start with you. Why are workers having a harder time getting workers' compensation?
So we decided to look at this issue because we're doing an overall series called Broken Whistle. We're looking at the state of whistleblowing in Wisconsin and also at the same time as a related issue, the waste, fraud, and abuse that Governor Walker wants to eliminate. And one of the areas where he's tried to eliminate waste is the workers' compensation program. And so that's why we started looking at it. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of stories did you hear as you went out to look at this?
Well, we looked, first of all, at the statistics, and they were hard to come by, and Luke will be able to fill us in much better on that. But what we found was that among the cases that are being decided by administrative law judges, that this is a contested case. There are like 30,000 cases a year. Most of them are resolved without a problem at all. About 5,000 of them are contested. Then you get a couple hundred, several hundred, that actually go to a hearing before an administrative law judge, and then some percentage of those go to this LA, the Labor and Industry Review Commission. What we found is that from about 10 years ago, about 29% of those ALJ, those judge decisions were appealed, and last year it was 59%.
So a lot more being appealed, and the decisions, do we see them more in favor of employers if they do get appealed?
Here's where I think Luke can
sure. Let's
fill in.
Throw that question to you, Luke.
Yeah, the answer is yes. I looked at LIRC cases, Labor and Industry Review Commission cases, between 2014 and 2016. I had to go find a lot of these cases that were not on the LIRC website. I had to go on Westlaw, read every single one, categorize them by issues decided to get an accurate picture of what it is that this current LIRC was doing. I found that of the significant issues that are decided in cases, at least during this period of time, LIRC reversed only 1% of ALJ judge decisions that were favorable to the employer, whereas they reversed 38% of the judge decisions that were favorable to the injured worker. So during this period of time, a pretty significant tilt toward insurance companies and employers.
And that time span, as you point out in that research, you say it corresponds with when Governor Walker's appointees were all on this board.
That's correct. They took full control, so to speak, of the LIRC in late 2013. So the reason I did this study was to find out what exactly they would do once they gained full control.
So somebody might say, okay, that means in the past they were too lenient. They let questionable workers' compensation cases stand. Now we're doing a better job controlling that, and we're saving money and not awarding frivolous, I guess, workers' compensation claims.
I don't think that that is the case. Given my experience before this LIRC began issuing their decisions starting in 2014, as I have said before, it's not like suddenly in 2014 everybody started committing fraud or had frivolous workers' compensation cases. There's very little fraud in the workers' compensation system in Wisconsin to begin with. These are legitimate cases where there is some dispute as to the extent of the disability and some room for argument, but these cases were being decided heavily against the injured worker, especially with regard to loss of earning capacity. Now, that was just this period of time. I have heard that since mid-2016, about the last year and a half, they have, the Labor and Industry Review Commission has moderated its stance somewhat.
And Dee, as you're reporting on this, using in part Luke's research, what kind of responses did you get from the commission when you presented those findings to them?
Well, they gave us a couple of responses. One of them is that there's no point in comparing the outcomes because each case has different facts. And so that's a fair point somewhat. There was a second response that they made talking about how often that they're upheld by the circuit court. And I think Luke had something to say about that.
I do, if I can get into that.
Sure.
Part of their response was the following quote, judging by the exceedingly high percentage of cases where the commission's, that's LURC, decisions are affirmed following a further appeal to the circuit court system, the commission is confident that its review of workers' compensation cases over the last several years has been both factual and legally sound. When I read that quote, when I read the story yesterday, for the first time, I was very surprised. That statement is somewhat misleading and I think requires clarification. That being that the LURC is the final decider of factual issues in a case. So which witness is telling the truth, which doctors are more credible, how much loss of earnings the person has. And so if that case is appealed then to the circuit court system, circuit court judges and the Court of Appeals, those courts cannot revisit those facts. So to say that the fact that LURC is not being reversed by the circuit courts and Court of Appeals is misleading in that LURC is the final decider of facts.
We're looking at workers' compensation in Wisconsin. Dee Hall is with us. She's been writing about this for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And Luke Kingrey is a workers' compensation attorney who practices in Eau Claire and Madison. I want to take a step back, Luke. You've worked on this from the employer side and the employee side. When an employee is injured on the job and they're losing wages because of it, unable to perform their functions anymore, talk us through the process.
Okay, the process is if you're off work following a work injury, you get 2/3 of your gross weekly wage as wage loss benefits during the healing period. Once you're done healing, you get a permanency rating and permanent restrictions. If you can't return to your job at roughly the same wage as before the injury, then you can claim loss of earning capacity benefits or retraining. That's it. That's workers' comp in a nutshell. There's no pain and suffering. There's no dollar-for-dollar loss of earning capacities. It's a very limited remedy. If your claim is denied because the insurance company hires a doctor saying that you either weren't injured at work or not injured very much, you have to contest that denial. And that process is heard in front of an administrative law judge. And any appeals of those judges' decisions go to LURC.
And Dee, as you mentioned, this has come up in the context of trying to cut back on fraud in government spending. And has the Walker administration talked about workers' compensation as a place where we might be seeing fraud?
Well, one thing that Governor Walker's administration did back in 2016 is they added a dedicated prosecutor to look only for workers' compensation fraud. So it's definitely a piece of a very large puzzle that they have created to try to attack waste, fraud, and abuse in things like Medicaid and food share and unemployment and workers' compensation. So it is one of the strategies that they have used.
And Luke, is workers' compensation a place where we see much in the way of fraud?
Very little. And I think even attorneys who represent employers and insurance companies, people who really know what they're talking about, would say the same thing. Very, very little when you're talking about people who are either making up the fact that they were injured at work and they actually hurt themselves over the weekend at home or something like that, or who are intentionally milking out their injuries. There's a little bit of that, but and I wouldn't even consider that fraud. I would just consider it, kind of a malingering issue. But there's very little fraud in the workers' compensation system in Wisconsin.
What's the reputation of Wisconsin when it comes to workers' compensation? If either of you can jump in on that.
Well, I know that historically we were seen as a leader in that. We were one of the first states to have a workers' compensation system. It's often called the grand bargain because the goal of it is to avoid litigation, to avoid every person who's injured on the job to have to hire a lawyer and then sue the company and then they start proving who's at fault. This gets rid of a lot of that. And for the most part, from what I understand, it works pretty well. I mean, the benefits aren't super generous, but, it's relatively smooth for most people who file. I don't know if you have a different opinion.
No, that's right in line. Wisconsin actually has the fastest return to work rates in the entire nation, and it's not even close. Workers in Wisconsin get back to work faster than anywhere else in the country. And in terms of medical treatment, they get some of the best medical treatment. And litigation rates, we have some of the lowest in the country. Very low litigation rate, especially compared to a state like Illinois.
Is the workers' compensation system prohibitively expensive for employers in Wisconsin, Luke?
No. In fact, rates for insurance rates or for employers in Wisconsin have gone down significantly in the past year, in fact, and have been on a downward trend. The Workers' Compensation Ratings Bureau is a separate state agency that sets rates in Wisconsin. We have a system like that. Other states don't. No employer goes out of business because of workers' comp insurance in the state of Wisconsin because the rates are capped. It is not an expensive system. It works relatively well, but when you put your fingers on the scale and tilt it toward one side or the other, that's when things start to break down.
And Dee, did you, in reporting this, get a sense that people are generally happy with the system in and of itself, maybe arguing over how it's going through this particular board, but not wanting to overhaul things?
So I think, you know, I would say overall, yes. But I will say that we did highlight three cases here in which people were very dissatisfied with the decisions that were made. One was Richard Decker, who was injured at Kohler Company. He worked in the line that manufactures toilets. Fell on his head, he had a brain injury. He was off work for quite a while. There was a dispute between his treating physicians and the doctors who were hired by Kohler, which is self-insured, and they felt that he had already healed, that he should be able to go back to work. But he did suffer from what appears, from my observation, having interviewed him over several hours and looked at a lot of doctor reports about his condition, that he suffered a multitude of effects from that are continuing to this day, and the accident happened back in 2010. So he was denied workers' compensation for that injury beyond the first few months after it occurred.
And Luke, as we wrap up, you mentioned the time scale of your research. Are you going to redo this research now to take more recent years into account?
I might. Then again, I might not, because it was such a significant undertaking. It took me about 100 hours of personal time to do. I would like to. Like I say, again, this is just a 2-year period of time. I have heard that Lurk has not been quite so insurance company and employer friendly here in the past year and a half. I'd like to see the data on it. Historically, the commissioners would tell you that they have a lean one way or the other, given their the political party that's in power. But I found this to be a little bit more than just a lean. It was pretty significant. I'd like to see what they're doing now.
Luke, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dee, good to have you back.
All right, thanks a lot.
We've been talking to Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, and Luke Kingrey, a workers' compensation attorney who practices in Eau Claire and Madison. They're with us today to talk about new reporting on why injured Wisconsin workers are sometimes having a harder time getting compensation. First, the Telemark Lodge in Cable, Wisconsin was one of the state's top winter getaways back in the 1970s and 80s, and it still serves as the starting spot for the American Birkebeiner cross-country ski race. But a series of bankruptcies plagued Telemark, and it's been closed since 2013. Now, a Florida-based company has reportedly reached an agreement to buy the lodge and turn it into a year-round resort. A bill to create an incremental tax district to help finance that project is getting a public hearing at the state capitol tomorrow. Area officials hope the project could be a big boost for the local economy in this northern Wisconsin community. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you vacation at Telemark Lodge when it was open? What are your memories? Would you go back? If this is a local story for you in the Cable area, are you hoping that it reopens, that it can boost that local economy? Call 800-642-1234. Barry Adams covers regional and business news for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's written about the past and future of Telemark Lodge. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Before we get into the history here, how big an impact would this be for that community and its economy if this project, a pretty big project, goes through?
Yeah, it's pretty big. They're talking about investing $47 million into the property that sold at a sheriff's auction back in 2011, I think, for like $2 million, sold at the sheriff's auction for like $1 million back in 2013. So they want to completely rehab this 1,000-acre property. They want to buy some adjacent property to provide some lake access because the resort is not on a lake. Of course, if you're in northern Wisconsin, lakefront is pretty popular. So they also want to expand the golf projects as well, so providing more golf. They used to have a golf course there, but it was sold off, and now they want to buy some of the golf courses up there. So it would be a significant impact. They're talking about, if this were to come to fruition, they're talking about a $25 million a year impact on the tourism economy of Bayfield County.
Tell us about the Telemark Lodge in its heyday.
Yeah, I mean, it's got a pretty long history. You know, it started out just as a ski hill back in the late 1940s, and they eventually added, you know, that opened in 1947. They added a chairlift to it in 1964, and then the lodge actually opened in 1972. It's got 215 rooms, and, you know, when it opened, it had tennis courts, had a nightclub, indoor swimming pool, had tennis courts, and, of course, many people remember, and it's still there, the 55-foot-tall stone fireplace in the lobby of the lodge, which they say they are going to retain in the project. You know, as you mentioned, you know, in your intro, this property has gone through a lot of ups and downs in its history, particularly in the 1980s and 90s and through the 2000s. And, you know, one of the things that you get when you talk to people up there is, you know, there's been a lot of promises, there's been a lot of proposals, and so I think people are kind of, they're tentatively and cautiously optimistic about what this project could do.
Right now it's a fixer-upper big time, it sounds like. I mean, some of this is just going to have to go and be replaced, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is beyond a fixer-upper. In fact, I toured the facility back in 2015. We were up there for a story on the property, and, you know, things are just dated. I mean, imagine going into a hotel that hasn't been updated since the 1970s, and you can imagine what you're working with. So what HK Hospitality Management wants to do, they're a company out of Florida, who actually one of their founders has a summer home in Hayward. So he's familiar with the property. And so what they want to do actually is tear out and remove the 215 rooms in the hotel and rebuild 250 modern-day hotel suites.
I want to bring on a caller now. Cindy is on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I'm so glad to hear they're bringing it back, because when I was in my my late teens, I used to hang out there with the gals. We'd go skiing for the weekend, and I remember the large stone fireplace in the lobby and the nightclub with all the great bands and the good food. And if you came there, you know, anytime during ski season, you met people from all over the world who were getting ready for the Birkebeiner. So it was just an awesome place to be.
Cindy, thanks a lot for that call. We've got another person who's sharing some memories and has a question, I think. Annie is on the line in Watertown. Annie, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just wondering how much it really benefits the community, because of the times I was up there. Boy, and they got it for a deal, too. They're going to make out like bandits. The times I was up there, we never really left the premises. We were sort of self-contained there and never contributed to the community, other than, I suppose, the workers would have some benefit, but
gotcha,
I don't see
Annie.
It.
Thanks for the call. So a couple people remember going there, at least one of them fondly, Barry, but is this something that's going to be too cut off from the local community to have an economic impact, Annie was wondering.
No, I don't think that's the case. I mean, you know, it's going to create jobs up there. You know, people are pretty mobile nowadays, and, you know, they're going to buy gasoline up there. They're going to rent snowmobiles in the wintertime. They're going to, you know, rent boats in the summertime. They're going to golf. You know, people aren't really going to just stay at that property per se. You know, one of the things that HK wants to do in this project, you know, this is more than just rehabbing this physical facility. It's also changing the business plan for this property. And a lot of different things have been tried before, and what HK wants to do is they want to come in and they want to create kind of self-contained deals in a way, but they want to have wine and, you know, wine and food events. They want to have concerts. They want to have things that are really going to draw people there. And a big part of that is also a corporate training center that they want to construct. So, you know, one of the things you got to realize too is that this is not a resort like in Walworth County or in Door County. This is pretty remote. I mean, this is 3 hours from the Twin Cities. You know, northeast of the Twin Cities, it's 5 hours from Madison. So, you know, they're trying to create events that are going to draw people there beyond just the Birkebeiner.
What kind of public help is the company looking for?
Yeah, it's unclear how much TIF assistance they want on this, but the TIF is mainly to run sewer and water lines to the lodge. Right now, it is not on public water and sewer, so they don't want to hook up to the nearest water and sewer system, so they could be on that.
Now, you mentioned there have been other plans, other big proposals here. The local community has been burned before, in effect. Are you getting a sense that they're optimistic that this might be the real deal?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you can't say that until it's all – it'd be really interesting to see what's, you know, what this is like 5 years from now. But HK has a pretty good track record. They're used to dealing with big brand hotel properties. And they've been working on this. This isn't just something that just happened up overnight. I mean, they've been working on this and studying this for almost 4 years. So they have really done their due diligence on this, I think. And, you know, if anybody's going to make this happen, they might be able to do it. I mean, this isn't just, you know, somebody coming in and saying, you know, let's spruce up the pool or something. They've got a pretty well-rounded attack plan for this property. But, again, I think people are, you know, cautiously optimistic. They want to see if this is actually going to happen, and I think the believers will believe once they see it happen.
Is there a timeline on the table here for when the doors would open and people could hit the slopes?
Yeah, they're supposed to close on the property in the next few weeks or maybe early February, and once they do that, they want to start deconstruction immediately. And they say they might be the 250 rooms, they might be open in time for the Berkey in 2019.
That's a pretty ambitious schedule, it sounds like, given the work involved.
Yeah.
Barry, thanks
a lot.
Thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet, Rob.
That's Barry Adams. He covers regional and business news at the Wisconsin State Journal. He's with us to talk about a renovation in the works, potentially, for Northern Wisconsin's Telemark Lodge. First.
Good evening, Dave.
How you doing, Hal?
Everything's running smoothly. And you?
Oh, not too bad.
Have you been doing some more work?
A few sketches.
May I see them?
Sure.
That's a very nice rendering, Dave. I think you've improved a great deal. By the way, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
No, not at all.
That's 2001, A Space Odyssey. We heard the voice of HAL 9000, the sentient computer in control of the spacecraft. When the movie came out back in 1968, that technology was seen as science fiction, something from the distant future. Well, here we are now with voice-activated speaker hubs like the Google Home and Amazon Echo controlling the climate in our homes and telling us whether our laundry's dry or not. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you thinking about jumping into this world of smart home devices, things like the Amazon Echo or the Nest thermostat? Have you already done this, or are you avoiding it? Are you thinking about giving one of these devices as a gift this holiday season? Are you worried about security and privacy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. With so many of these smart devices on the market, it can be hard to know where to start. Haley Tsukuyama joins us now. She's a technology reporter at the Washington Post. Haley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, these things were novelties not that long ago, really quite expensive. We're getting to the point now where average consumers have a lot of choices on the market, don't they?
Yes, absolutely. Not only, you know, have we seen Google and Amazon really compete heavily for this space, Microsoft has partnered with a company that's owned by Samsung for their own Cortana speaker. And also, you know, we're seeing all of these companies sort of offer speakers at lots of different prices. So, you know, there's a lot more choice this year.
And with that basic system, I don't even know what we're calling. You just call it hubs, I guess. What do they do?
Yes.
What all can we do with them?
Sure. So in sort of basic terms, you can ask them, you know, for the weather, for the traffic. You can ask them, you know, if you want to hook it up to your calendar, you can ask them what you have going on that day. You can ask them sort of basic questions, you know, how many teaspoons in a tablespoon, that sort of thing. And then if you want, you can, you know, if you buy other devices that work with them, smart light bulbs, smart thermostats, then their skills really expand depending on what other appliances you buy.
So I can see somebody thinking, yeah, this might be cool, and if this was me, being really overwhelmed by all the stuff on the market. So if somebody's out there thinking, yeah, maybe I want to do this, what kind of questions should they be asking themselves, maybe even before they hit the stores or the websites?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think really the first thing that you should be asking yourself when you're thinking about getting a home hub is, you know, kind of look at the options on the market. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, sort of the same three or five companies run our lives. But, you know, some people are Google people, some people are Amazon people, some people are Microsoft people. So really think about sort of which company services you use the most, and then, you know, you pick the, I think, pick the hub that gels best with sort of your own use in your life.
Right, because if I get one brand of hub, but I've got other brands of computers and somebody else's speaker, there's no guarantee they're all going to talk to each other. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. So the goal for these companies, you know, we'll get to privacy and security a little later, but the goal for these companies is to really find another area in which they can, you know, touch your lives. So definitely think about, you know, if you're a shopper, you might want to go with Amazon. If you use a lot of Google services, you might want to go with Google, you know, that sort of thing.
Haley Tsukuyama is with us from the Washington Post. We're looking at the high-tech household, home hubs and thermostats, smart appliances, that sort of thing. And Haley, you just touched on maybe a big worry for a lot of people, the privacy and security concerns. I know there have been stories over the past few years about smart appliances having virtually no security, creating big vulnerabilities. What's out there now? Should we be worried?
You know, it's a very complicated landscape. I think in most cases, if you stick with some of the big brands and you can kind of do maybe a little bit of research and see, you know, if they let you put a password, for example, password protect your appliances. I always recommend anything that will let you put a password on it, you should put a password on it. And then there are also some routers, which is sort of a boring appliance, but now we're definitely seeing, you know, people are introducing routers that introduce security at the network level so that you aren't having to go in and fiddle with everything. You can just do it, you know, once from your router.
Yeah, I feel like I already have enough passwords in my life if I needed a password for my refrigerator functioning or something like that. I think that might put me over a certain limit.
Yeah, I know. There was a day a couple of months ago when I was trying to remember the password for my light bulbs, and I thought, this is no way to live.
Yeah, so you have a smart light system. I mean, do you feel like it makes your life easier, Haley?
There's certainly times when it does feel like magic, right? You know, when you're really comfortable in bed, you maybe fell asleep reading, and you just want to tell the lights to turn themselves off. That can be really nice. But setting them up can be kind of a pain. And, you know, I mean, I like to test these things because, you know, I obviously think about where tech is going. But so they have their advantages and they have their disadvantages, I'd say.
I want to bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jason is on the line in Neenah. Jason, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Jason?
I actually work for and an owner of a home automation system, Iris by Lowe's. Not sure if you're familiar with that.
I'm not familiar. Haley?
I'm not super familiar, but I certainly know the name.
Okay, yeah, there's quite a few customers, well over 100,000. And the integration is really simple with Alexa, Google Home, the Nest thermostat, the Philips Hue lights. You can schedule lights to turn on and off certain times of day according to sunrise, sunset. I actually have 5 cameras on the system that you can view whenever you want. And your recordings, things like that. So it's a safety and it's a security and home automation system in one.
So you've got those cameras there as a security thing?
Yes.
All right, Jason, thanks a lot for calling and sharing your story. And Haley, that's part of what people are looking at here is things like security. So you can look and see if somebody's at the door, who's at the front door. If you're away, you could see if somebody's coming in out of your house. That's part of the appeal here?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We're seeing a lot of interest in smart doorbells and outdoor security cameras. And, you know, a lot of people get sort of indoor, you know, almost like baby monitors, right, that kind of idea, and they point it at their door. So we're seeing a lot of companies jump into that space, both from the tech side and then also from the home security side, as he was mentioning.
Jason, thanks for that call. And I've read, Haley, that this is being looked at as something maybe with potential for seniors, where somebody younger might think, oh, it's not a big deal. I can get up and go down the stairs and lock the door and turn off the lights and things like that. This might be really convenient for seniors who have less mobility and who can, you know, have family members help keep track of some of these things going on.
Yeah, that's certainly something, you know, they've been talking about, you know, that this will let people stay in their homes, in their own homes for longer, which I think is appealing to a lot of people, you know, just so that you know you can, you know, you can check in on your grandmother or your mother remotely. You can see if she locked the door, or, you know, you can make sure that the stove's turned off, stuff like that. I think you're right. That certainly has its appeal.
Now, you wrote an interesting piece, Haley, at the other end of the age range, kids growing up in this household where there's this magical character that they can talk to and will talk back to them, whether it's the Amazon Echo or something like that. And this has child psychologists wondering, hey, what is this going to do for kids?
Yeah, it's a really interesting area, sort of the kids tech, because, of course, you know, we're still sort of grappling with, okay, you know, what is having smartphones our whole lives doing to our brains? And now, of course, sort of we have this magic person in this box. I think, you know, some child psychologists are a little concerned that, you know, kids are going to ask the robot questions instead of their friends or instead of their parents. And so they just advise, you know your own kid and kind of decide, you know, what is age appropriate for them, and then you have some times when they're not near the the assistant, and you know, maybe make them turn off their own lights.
Haley Tsukuyama is with us. She's a technology reporter at the Washington Post, and we're talking about smart technology in the home. Everything from smart thermostats to internet connected refrigerators. There are toothbrushes and forks out there too. Maybe we'll talk about that. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these hubs like the Amazon Echo or Google Home? Or are you thinking about buying one? Have you been adding smart technology to your home, stuff that's connected via your wireless that you can keep track of with your phone? Or maybe you don't want this technology becoming a part of your daily life. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Haley Tsukuyama is with us, technology reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking about the ever-increasing variety of smart devices out there on the market. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been adding smart technology to your home? Do you have a hub like the Amazon Echo? Do you have any questions for our technology reporter about something you have or might get? Are you worried about security issues, privacy concerns? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Steve is with us in East Troy. Steve, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a little older, so I'm in my 60s, and I'm not a big fan of all the technology, but when I want to buy something, I have to get it anyway. I needed to get a new garage door opener, and it has to have everything on it. It costs a lot more. It's not something I want to use. It seems like availability of options are being left out of not doing it.
Steve, thanks so much for that call. Haley, is Steve right? He's seeing it's hard to buy a dumb version of some things like a garage door opener. Is that how the market is changing?
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. I think a lot of companies are looking at these, you know, sort of smart technologies as a way to sell you a service, right? So you might not just get a camera, you might want to get a security service with it, that sort of thing. And so it is getting harder, as Steve said, you know, especially I think we see this a lot with televisions, right? Samsung, I think, last year was the first year that they didn't have any dumb televisions that were new models. And so I think that's definitely a concern that I hear from other people.
Thanks a lot for that call, Steve. We'll go next to Sarah online in Appleton. Sarah, hi.
Hi. My husband is a software developer, and Alexa has become essentially a member of our family. We have a 9-year-old and a 2-year-old. And our 2-year-old has figured out how to say Alexa, and he will walk up to her and talk to her. His newest thing is walking up to Alexa and telling her no. But our 9-year-old daughter has, I think, become pretty dependent on her. And I know you had just made the comment about encouraging your kids to get up and turn off lights and things like that. And my daughter will be steps away from the light in the living room and yet ask Alexa to do that. So I just really find it interesting and really do think that there's a lot of research out there as far as that child kind of psychology element of how this is affecting kids.
Yes, Sarah, do you find this fun and cute, worrisome, somewhere in between, a little of both?
Yep, I think it's definitely both. And it's my husband takes things much further than I ever would, being a software developer. Our garage door, our house lights, our stove and fridge, every light in our house, our Christmas tree, almost everything in our house is now automated, our TV, everything. And so I can see, like, the benefit of it, but I worry because we joke that my two-year-old, that Alexa is his first girlfriend.
Huh.
Because he communicates with her, and he used to call her Pua. We don't know why. But he's figured out how to say Alexa, and we're just kind of, I get a little bit worried about that.
Sarah, thank you so much. Haley, I'm guessing this conversation is going on in more households than just Sarah's, and probably maybe after this holiday season, a lot more beyond that.
Yeah, right. It's certainly something that we're hearing about. You know, as I said, child psychologists are looking to this. You know, they're really kind of interested. Not, I wouldn't say across the board concerned. You know, but definitely interested in sort of what this is going to do to early childhood development. I'm not a parent myself, but I have spoken to a lot of parent advocacy groups, and they say if you are worried, you know, just maybe say, okay, no devices at dinner or no devices every, you know, second Saturday or something. If you're getting concerned, that it's okay to exert your power as a parent and say, let's do some device-free time.
You know, with all that stuff connected, I definitely worry about security. I mean, even with a password-protected router, nothing is completely safe. I mean, with all that connected, you could pretty quickly, if you had an interested hacker take control, have a high-tech version of the Amityville Horror or Poltergeist in your house.
Yeah, well, that's certainly a worry, you know, and I think we're going to see people sort of adopt these things in different ways, right? Right now, a lot of companies are pushing, for example, smart door locks. That, you know, for some people may be a bridge too far. They may say, no, you know, I really want a low-tech key, you know, that goes in my door that I can turn, that I know can't be, you know, locked by someone else somewhere else.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sarah. We're talking to Haley Tsukuyama, a technology reporter at the Washington Post, looking at smart technology in our homes, concerns about it, and the huge variety of products, bewildering almost, out there. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Rice Lake. Mike, hi.
Hi. Well, I teach Internet of Things, and what I find so far is that it's more of a novelty than a real breakthrough technology that's going to improve quality of life. But we're on the threshold. It's getting there. What I see holding it back right now is there isn't what I call a killer app that will allow all the devices to function. Right now, each manufacturer has their own interface. Some are using Bluetooth, some use Wi-Fi, some use another type of wireless technology. And for that typical homeowner to try to learn all these different technologies is going to be an impedance to their adoption.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And Haley, do you think this is something that's holding people back, that the learning curve may still be a little too high unless you're somebody like, you know, Sarah's husband, the software developer?
Yeah, I think that's certainly that's a great point. And I think, you know, people have been asking me about holiday gifts, of course, and I keep saying, well, you know, this is fun technology, but make sure that you know the person that you're buying for, right? If they're not the kind of person who's willing to sit down and troubleshoot sometimes, then, you know, maybe it's not for them, or maybe your gift could include your time to set it up as well.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. It seems like the one device that I hear people talking about being really useful is the smart thermostat. Can you talk about how that works, Haley?
Sure. So a smart thermostat is, you know, connected. You can control it from your phone. You can also sort of program it to, you know, turn down while you're away in case, you know, you're one of those people who forgets to turn the thermostat down when you leave the house. And you can set it to heat up your house before you get home, which is always nice, especially in colder weather. So that's sort of how that works. And it can also kind of learn your habits and optimize sort of the energy output. So it can save people money if you set it up right.
Right. I mean, I've got a thermostat with a digital timer on it. It's not wireless connected or anything like that. Is it really that big a step, to have it be internet connected or wireless connected? And I guess the advantage was I could if I knew I was coming home early, turn it on earlier than the timer wanted to?
Yeah, that's essentially sort of what people are thinking. Or, you know, if you have it running on a routine, then maybe you're not necessarily going to fiddle with it if you're a little bit chilly, and so, you know, you're not kind of messing around with the program a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it is sort of a small convenience, but for some people it makes some people really appreciate that kind of freedom. So
I'd like to take another caller now. David is with us in Slinger. David, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to say that my brother's wife has MS, and she's in multiple sclerosis, and she's pretty far along. And they used the smart technology. If she is having trouble, she can say, "Alexa, Grandma's having trouble." And if he's outside, it sets, because they live on a farm, it sets off a siren, as well as his smartphone, so he can come get her. She can do things that she just couldn't do without it. We actually used it several years ago when my father was dying, and it just gave everyone a lot more mobility, felt more secure. It is truly amazing.
David, thank you so much for sharing that story. We talked a bit about seniors earlier than Haley, but that's an angle I hadn't thought of. People with conditions like MS, people with disabilities, there's a lot of potential here, isn't there?
Yes, there is a lot of potential. And I think a lot of, sort of the medical profession and just a lot of companies are looking at other ways that they can use voice control technology to help people's lives.
Thanks a lot for that call, David. So, Haley, you mentioned gift buying. That's part of why we were talking to you this time of year. Is there a sense like on the market, these are the things that people are buying as gifts when it comes to smart technology?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Of course, even though it would be pretty late to be getting gifts right now, the season isn't quite over. But
well, I think
what we're seeing is a lot of people are kind of looking at this as a self gift, or a gift for their household, so that they can fiddle around with it more. Certainly with some of the smaller speakers, it could be good for a dorm room or something like that. But I think it's a lot of people giving gifts with good knowledge of who's receiving it.
And Haley, is there a device maybe that's not out on the market this holiday season, but that you're looking forward to at least checking out, something you're excited about on the horizon?
In January, the technology, kind of consumer technology industry as a whole, has a big show in Las Vegas. And so right now I'm getting a lot of pitches about that. And there are a couple of things, there are some like laundry robots. Like, I really hate folding laundry, and so there's a robot that claims it can do that, and it's early days, so we'll see how convenient it actually is. But that's the sort of thing that the labor intensive chores that I would like to shove off onto a robot.
Briefly, have you seen video of this thing folding fitted sheets yet? Because that would be worth
I
some
haven't.
Money. All right, we'll keep an eye on that. Haley, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Haley Sukiyama is a technology reporter at The Washington Post. We've been talking about the growing variety of smart devices on the market. You can still offer up your thoughts, maybe your experiences, why you've gotten something, how it works, or why you're avoiding it over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.